Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Public Radio Missile Silo on West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. It's Tuesday, June 19th, 2018. Glad to have you along for a discussion of constitutional amendments, a redistricting punt, and the passing of a Carolina chancellor. My name is Jeff Tiberi. Welcome to the program. Here to discuss those topics and more is the executive director of the North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, Jonathan Kapler.
Thanks for having me back.
So we were settling in here and just discussing what's going on, what we are guessing is going on in the days to come, and also just kind of the proverbial pulse, if you will of North Carolina politics. What is top line for you right now? What are you watching and monitoring?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly paying attention to what the legislature is doing, how it's being covered in the media, how the public is reacting to it, and how really it's setting us up for the political debates for the fall campaign, because this is what's going to be probably freshest in the minds of voters come the election. I'm also paying attention to what the kind of advocacy organizations are doing in terms of their advertising around some of the issues before the legislature. And really who they're concentrating their efforts on, because I think that to a large extent that gives you some clues about where there may be some investment by outside groups come the fall campaign.
Budget obviously gets a lot of the air in the room. The voter ID proposed constitutional amendment, I think, kind of spiked that news cycle. What else from your perspective as we think about this, really just this last month and a few days since that the big teacher rally in mid-May? What have been, you know, the things to most percolate across perhaps the marginal political followers here in the state?
Yeah, I definitely think the voter ID is a big one. The constitutional amendments as a set, right?
Right.
That's in process. We don't know exactly what is ultimately going to be asked of the voters to consider in November. But the process by which Republicans are legislating is an area that Democrats have been consistently critical of. And by and large, I don't think voters really care that much about process. Having said that, if Democrats are able to use that as part of a narrative against Republican overreach in government in North Carolina, then it may have some salience for the politics of the campaign in the fall.
We'll get back to voter ID in a second. There are other proposed constitutional amendments that we are expecting. Brief context here. Since the state constitution was last ratified in 1971, there have, I believe, been 45 proposed constitutional amendments, 38 of those have passed. So if it gets to the ballot, historically, looking across the last 46, 47 years, pretty good track record of those passing. We're looking at a potential limit, a reduction in the limit on personal income tax. It's currently at 10, could be kicked down to 5.5. A proposed constitutional amendment dealing with enshrining victims' rights, another kind of codifying the right to hunt and fish. And still, indication that came today, Tuesday, from House Rules Chair David Lewis is that something is in the works as it relates to the Board of Elections. What to you other than voter ID? I'm going to put voter ID at the top. What after that is most significant or interesting as we think about the fall?
Yeah, I think the capping of the state sales tax of 5.5% is probably the most popular idea that's out there. I think one that is more controversial, and we haven't heard a lot about it recently, but it'll be interesting to see if there's any push by the more conservative elements of the Republican Party to get in a constitutional amendment before the voters around TABOR, what's known as TABOR, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, which kind of ties the growth in state government spending to GDP and I think state population growth. That one is, I think, definitely much more uncertain. But I think Right to Work is also another interesting one, which we've heard a little bit less about as of late, but it's already in state statute. But is not part of the state constitution, and that is one that could be controversial. So the concept of these constitutional amendments, especially if there's multiple of them, that they could potentially kind of motivate turnout or distract Democrats and their allies from legislative contests, important and close legislative contests, soak up money from groups that are trying to oppose them, especially in light of the fact that we typically support them as voters in North Carolina when they come to the ballot. There's a lot of interesting kind of threads here to follow that are not just policy oriented, but also political in nature.
So we think about this being potentially wedge issues, potentially voter mobilization efforts. With voter ID, what is your calculus or expectation for where that falls and how this breaks down?
Yeah, so I think Republicans in the legislature, the notion all along has been that these constitutional amendments are designed in part to appeal to conservative voters and give them another reason to turn out to vote in the fall. And I think that the Republicans' calculus on this is that the downside risks are quite minimal, given that Democrats, by and large, thus far have demonstrated an enthusiasm level that is unusual for a midterm election year. And so the upset that may be generated towards a voter ID constitutional amendment will be, I think, minimal in the context of those constituencies are already agitated. And so for Republicans in the legislature, I think it's generally more of an upside for them that their voters would be more potentially motivated to turn out that might not otherwise to vote for it.
So one of the things I've heard from the left repeatedly, and I've heard the right counter it, and I mean both publicly and also just in private conversations, folks from the right have said you're missing the point here, you're missing this. But folks from the left have said this could backfire, the voter ID proposed constitutional amendment. You look at African-American turnout in the last two midterms, 2010 and 2014. We should note both of those did have a statewide U.S. Senate race here in North Carolina. But those on the left say that this could energize the African-American turnout, which was low in both of those years. Both of those years, which had an African-American president, though he was not on the ballot in those years. The folks on the right have countered and said, listen, that's not what this is about. Those folks are already mobilized. They're already energized because of the man in the White House, because of Donald Trump. Where do you fall on this split in terms of how a proposed constitutional amendment may or may not affect African-American turnout?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just keeps the talking point and the messaging fresh for Democrats. I probably think more along the lines of the Republicans' perspective on this, in the sense that those constituencies are largely already motivated. But interestingly, in North Carolina, given our unique election cycle that we're entering into, where there is not a marquee statewide contest on the ballot, turnout is going to be very uneven across the state. And so it'll be interesting to see where a lot of resources are poured into the state, notably in the 9th and 13th congressional districts, which are squarely on the national radar as competitive contests. If these messages get lost, if they are a motivating factor for various constituencies there, and in the absence of a motivating race like that, where a lot of resources, especially from outside the state, are coming in, is potentially the voter ID or other issues a motivating force for constituencies on the left and right and areas of the state that otherwise aren't getting a lot of political advertising.
So, and correct me, of course, at any point if I am mistaken. I believe this is a blue moon election, right? So we're talking about a midterm without that statewide political race, that statewide U.S. Senate race. Last time it happened was 2006. Voter turnout was about 38%, and that was the lowest voter turnout since 1972. Where do you expect, if you have a sense of it this early in the game, where we're going to see the most? Is it the 9th and the 13th? Where are we going to see the most voters turning out in November?
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot. Traditionally, in the Triangle media market, particularly Wake County, where there's a lot more consistent coverage of politics and government here, and voters that, by and large, I think a little bit more attuned to that anyways. And then I think the urban areas where it's a little bit easier to organize folks, and then the 9th and 13th congressional districts, which the 9th is kind of Charlotte to Fayetteville, and then the 13th is kind of the Triad Southwest area there. And so you are going to see, I think, a lot of effort there. Now, I will say that just like we saw in the primary elections that we had in May, that turnout sometimes is not necessarily driven by the top of the ticket, but is often driven by the bottom of the ticket. And so some local races that have particular resonance for voters, often sheriff's races, will sometimes have an up ballot effect where they're generating turnout because of hot local issues.
Do you know, throwing you on the spot here, how many sheriff's races there are this fall?
Well, I think they're all on the ballot.
All 100 counties.
But whether or not they've got contested or very competitive races, that is, I don't know that.
Okay. Jonathan Kapler, Executive Director of the NC Free Enterprise Foundation. You can follow him on Twitter, where he is wonderfully active, at Jonathan Kapler, double P in there, with the Kapler. Let me ask you about the context, if you have any context to share, as it relates to Tabor, this taxpayer bill of rights, and also voter ID. Voter ID was a proposed constitutional amendment in Missouri 2 years ago. I think a similar measure moved in Wisconsin. Taxpayer bill of rights is old. I think the only state that's touched it is Colorado. A generation ago. Is there anything to glean from those places as these issues play out here, or are we kind of searching, or am I searching by asking that question?
Well, I think the fact that it's still pretty rare across the country as part of a state's constitution gives you some indication that it is not a slam dunk, and that the conversations that I've heard here at the General Assembly in Raleigh is that sometimes it's still as if the conversation is active amongst Republicans. Mm-hmm. Often the debates that take place in committee on the floor and elsewhere, it's clearly kind of Republicans trying to convince Democrats or vice versa. And with Tabor, you get some sense that while the rhetoric is kind of broadly directed, it's often kind of couched in terms that are really more focused on getting Republican colleagues to sign on to that idea.
One very specific follow-up here as it pertains to voter ID, and then we're going to move on. But I'm wondering if there are particular candidates, either incumbents or challengers, who you're expecting to perhaps stay away from this issue. I mean, from my perspective, we fully expect some Democrats, already have heard from some, to say, you know, this is a voter suppression move. This is, this comes in the face of racist policy. I mean, we know what some of the rhetoric's going to be, but I wonder about, and I'll use just someone as an example, and I have not talked to him personally about this, but it is Joe John, who's in the North Carolina House. He's a Democrat. He took a seat from a Republican 2 years ago. I think he's going to be in a relatively close race this fall. So I wonder if there are people like him who will distance themselves from this issue, because if they come out and say, this is a terrible policy, this is a terrible proposed constitutional amendment, in turn, their Republican allies or their Republican challenger adversary is probably going to whack him over the head with it in a campaign ad. Do you expect that? And if so, who are those Democrats that might try to steer clear of this issue?
Right. Well, number one, I'd say that there are grades of how to approach these issues. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just kind of all in or all out on this. You can be opposed to it and vote against something like that, but not make it a central plank of your reelection campaign and downplay it and focus on other things in your campaign literature. And a lot of folks think that campaigns are kind of the competing answers to the same question. And often campaigns are really about what the question is itself. And so if you're winning on the merits of the campaign's being waged on my terms, on the issues that I want to talk about, then that's really the ball game. And so if you're controlling that narrative within your district or your race, then you're doing a pretty good job. Now, to answer your question more specifically, I think there, specifically in the House, there are a handful of Democrats, largely in more rural areas, that may have a kind of tightrope to walk on some of these issues that are probably popular amongst their electorate. Again, they have to make some decisions as to whether or not these issues are motivating for those voters to vote for or against them themselves. And the same thing applies, I think, to largely suburban Republicans that are facing, I think, competitive races. Joe John, Representative Joe John, Democrat here in Wake County, who is facing a rematch against the legislator
That's right.
previously had beaten, former Representative Marilyn Avila. So expected to be a competitive race, interesting contours to that contest. And then in a neighboring district, a Republican held seat, Chris Malone, who's also facing a rematch against Terrence Everett, a Democrat there. So those will be an interesting kind of contrast in terms of how they approach this. You've got a Democratic incumbent, Republican incumbent, both trying to navigate a very fast-moving, a fast-growing community where the demographics are changing quite rapidly. And so is this a situation where the Democrat and Republican actually kind of sound similar that are incumbents on this? We'll see.
Believe it. It's possible. Republicans, Democrats sounding similar, at least on the campaign trail. Let's chat redistricting. There was a case, an appeal out of Wisconsin that many would have you believe was a landmark decision in the making. It was coming. Partisan redistricting was going to end in the United States. But of course, how could it end? I mean, this is an American political pastime. This goes back 240 years or what? I mean, Governor Elbridge, Jerry Elbridge was 1811. there wasn't a landmark decision on redistricting this week, either in Wisconsin or in Maryland. What was your what were your main takeaways? What was your biggest takeaway from that punt yesterday?
Yeah, it was kind of a double punt, right?
Yeah, double punt
with Wisconsin and Maryland cases really being decided on procedural grounds and not on the substantive merits of those arguments around partisan gerrymandering. I think there's several takeaways broadly. One is, and one selfishly, is that this really puts North Carolina potentially at the center of the conversation around partisan gerrymandering, given that our—
And why is that?
Yeah. That's because we were one of three national cases. These were the other two that had broad implications for the legality of partisan gerrymandering and whether or not there's some judiciable standard associated with that, kind of in the Goldilocks scenario of politics as an inherent part of redistricting, but how much is too much? You know, what's okay, what's not okay? And so our case was simply just further behind in the legal process than these two that had already made it to the Supreme Court. Ours has been decided by a special three-judge federal panel and is basically on substantive appeal before the U.S. Supreme Court, which has not yet decided whether or not it will accept our case and hear our case.
Right.
But that could happen very soon. And then we could theoretically hear, the Supreme Court could hear that case in the next term, so starting in the fall. And so ours is basically poised to be the next one. Also, I think that there's some sense that the procedural issues that that tied up the Wisconsin case are not necessarily present in ours.
Right.
And there could be other procedural issues that tie up ours. But the bottom line is I think there's some sense that ours presents a little bit more of a clean shot at deciding what constitutes a real partisan gerrymandering, what's legal and what's constitutional and what's not constitutional. And just for the recap, our congressional districts were declared unconstitutional for excessive partisanship by this three-judge federal panel in January of 2018, and that was the first time in the history of our country that congressional districts had been ruled unconstitutional for those reasons. Which, you know, we're number one in something, maybe not what we want to be, but there's definitely something there.
So that three-judge panel, I believe it was Wynn, Eagles, and Schroeder. I might be wrong on that, but regardless, I believe it was a 2-1 split. I don't believe it was unanimous, but they ruled that these districts, which were drawn because they were previously struck down for being illegal racial gerrymanders, drawn in 2016, they did maintain that 10-3 Republican-Democratic split among the congressional seats in North Carolina, held that 10-3 split. And that is what was ruled an illegal partisan gerrymander. It was appealed to the Supreme Court, and we just don't know yet whether they will take it, whether they will hear oral arguments. And we should know that by the end of the year?
We'll know. It could be as early as next week,
right,
when the Supreme Court decides whether or not they want to hear the case. And okay, I will say, going back to your original question, the outcomes of the Wisconsin and Maryland cases, at least the outcomes as they stand right now, do give you some sense about how hesitant the U.S. Supreme Court is in weighing in on this. The real hope from the Wisconsin case was that there would be some standard, and there had been a proposed kind of evaluation as to partisanship and whether or not this provided us an appropriate metric, right, to judge partisanship, and they just bypassed that altogether. Mm-hmm. Our case thus far has not really provided a judiciable standard. It really reviewed the totality of the evidence, and so I think that is what map drawers across the country are really looking for is, okay, well, if you don't like it, then what is the standard? And it's a similar situation with the racial gerrymandering as well, but there's been sufficient, I think, jurisprudence to give folks a little bit more guardrails there on how to approach those things, even though folks still get tripped up on that.
I tend to think we're not any close, even with if a landmark decision were to come, landmark ruling in the next year or two, I remain unconvinced that we're any closer to having some sort of uniform or widespread move to independent redistricting. But crystal ball, totally shooting the you-know-what and spitballing here, is redistricting fundamentally changed 5 years from now? From Jonathan Kapler's crystal ball, as you're looking into it.
I think that we have seen, especially as technology has advanced, that we just can't always anticipate the issues that are going to arise mm-hmm. with this. And as the combination, I think, of technology, the combination of our growth and development patterns in this state and across the country, just new and unanticipated legal and political issues kind of arise. And so that is, I think, where the Supreme Court is they don't want to necessarily set a standard that could be eclipsed in a very short period of time and then get outdated.
Sure.
So it's a real struggle, and I wouldn't want to be the guy drawing the maps, honestly. It's a hard job.
On a much different note, David Belcher, former chancellor of Western Carolina University, died on Sunday. This was almost 2 years ago after he was diagnosed with brain cancer. He led the Western Carolina campus for 6 years, and it was through a time, from my perspective, and I think many other perspectives, of really unprecedented growth. I've seen the word passion, I feel like, with every tribute or memorial that has popped up, either from a news outlet or on social media in the last couple of days. You knew him. I'm not entirely sure how well, but you knew him. If you would indulge us in a story or a memory.
Sure. So I was an advocate for the UNC system, both at the state and federal levels. And so in that capacity, got a chance to get to know many of the chancellors quite well, including Chancellor Belcher, who was kind of an endless source of energy and kindness. And he has a lot of things to point to as part of his legacy of really making a difference at Western Carolina, which I will say, as a proud Appalachian alum, there's a friendly fishy. Mountain family rivalry amongst mountain institutions in the state, but which he was always quick to make a joke about, by the way. But his humor and good grace was always on display. And for him, I think the key is not necessarily the physical and tangible things that he did for Western Carolina, $110 million science facility, which is critical, designation of part of their campus as a millennial campus, which brings a lot of opportunities to students. But he really, I think, doubled down on creating an environment at Western Carolina that could be home for a lot of students, that met the needs of the region and the state, and really created a place in Cullowhee, which, by the way, Western Carolina is the largest university in the country that is not in any incorporated community. Cullowhee is a zip code, not a town.
It's a good Friday fact.
Yeah, and but he put Western Carolina on the map in a short 6 years.
Yeah.
And he just was a really kind person and super funny and always proudly wearing his purple and always poked fun at me when I was wearing my black and gold.
David Belcher sadly was just 60 when he died on Father's Day on Sunday this past weekend. All right, on a lighter note, it is lightning round time. We'll transition out of sadness to kind of the obscure and the quirky. One state capital that you've never been to that you would like to visit?
Ooh, that's a good one. Let's say Carson City, Nevada.
Carson City, Nevada. Why?
Because it's far away and there's a really good political reporter out there that I like.
Okay. Favorite season of The Wire?
I've never seen The Wire.
That takes care of that. College World Series taking place right now in Omaha. UNC lost last night, Monday night, to Mississippi State. It wasn't even close. It was like 12-2. They'll play Oregon State tomorrow in an elimination game. How closely are you watching?
I'm watching from the pride of a North Carolinian, okay. Right? Happy to have any North Carolina team make it that far.
World Cup, are you over under 3.5 matches you'll watch by the time this tournament's over?
Oh, I'll definitely be over. Okay. I've kind of been behind so far, but I'll get there.
Is there a net without the U.S. in this, who are you pulling for?
So my grandparents immigrated from Germany, and so my kind of default is for Germany, but sure. They lost to Mexico,
right.
Which was a fabulous game. I did watch that one, and Mexico totally deserved to win that, but I still have some allegiance to Germany.
1-0, I think that one, and that's like Group F's, like the group of death this time around, right?
Yeah. I forget now offhand who else is in there, but
Sweden and South Korea, maybe.
Yeah, it's tough, and there have been some upsets. You know, I just think the parity across the world has risen, right?
For sure.
And it's just anybody's game.
Yep. Best beach in North Carolina.
I have to be partial to Oak Island. My parents have a place near there, and it's just a lovely, lovely place.
When will you be there next? If you don't mind me asking.
Over 4th of July. Nice. Come on down, folks.
Jonathan Kapler, Executive Director of the NC Free Enterprise Foundation, thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Always a pleasure.
Good to have you here as well. If you enjoyed the program, tell somebody about it. Feel free to subscribe as well. iTunes, Google Play, et cetera, et cetera. I'm actually off to the beach tomorrow. Not entirely sure who will be with you next, but until then, you can stay up to date with political happenings, hashtag NCPOL, and at our website, WUNC.org. For Jonathan, I'm Jeff. Talk to you again soon.